Welcome to Bombshell. I'm Erin Simpson.
I'm Lauren Dion-Shulman.
And I'm Radha Iyengar.
And we are here without a guest this week. We actually wanted a guest this week.
Yeah, we tried and we kind of failed.
It turns out the holiday season, which is just sort of everything that happens between Thanksgiving and New Year's, is kind of a Charlie Foxtrot. So, right.
So if you wanted to know more about either China or Gaza, you should listen to another podcast. But just know that we tried.
We tried. And because we didn't get a guest, we're really not going to talk about either of those things.
Not in the least.
There are lots of things that happen in the world in a given week. And some weeks we struggle to edit it down, and some weeks we struggle to figure out what exactly happened in the last 10 days that we should talk to all you all about. So here's what we figured out for this week. Before we get started, actually, Lauren, what are you going to release next week?
Next week, we are releasing our annual holiday gift guide, which is going to be as fabulous, if not more fabulous, than last year. Please reference it for all of the bombshells in your life, or the bombshell fans in your life, and I hope you will greatly enjoy.
Meanwhile, Lauren, what are we drinking?
We are drinking Rosa de Venti Lambrusco dell'Emilia, which is just frizzy red wine of some kind. It's really good.
You're just saying words.
It's from the Latin wine shop here in Shaw. It's from Gran Cata, where they will be happy to pick out a delicious wine for you of your choosing. So it's fantastic. Radha, what are you drinking?
I'm drinking an icy cold glass of milk, which is refreshing, but also critical because I'm eating a giant bowl full of brownies.
Oh man, Lauren, I totally forgot to make you brownies.
I may forgive you since you brought the fizzy red wine. And also I'm eating Stollen, which is basically Alsatian Christmas fruitcake, which I think I'm the only person on the planet who loves. But it's really good. It has so much marzipan in it. Just like this giant log of marzipan throughout.
Oh, man.
It's great.
I love many things about German Christmas, but marzipan has never been one of them.
Yeah, with Aaron on this one. I'm sorry.
Okay. Well, shall we keep up some foreign relations? I feel like there's a lot going on. Yeah. We're going to start in Afghanistan, which we used to do, like, this is still a thing, but now we actually just end up talking about Afghanistan, like, every week, it seems like.
I mean, it is still a thing.
It is still a thing, and we definitely still have lots of troops there, but, man, the Taliban are just on a frickin' tear. I saw one report that noted that there were over 40 people killed in 24 hours this week in Afghanistan, and that was in a mix of attacks in Kabul and Helmand province. And it was a pretty deadly week for American soldiers or servicemen as well. We had four servicemen killed in action in Ghazni and in Helmand province as well. So I don't have like a great, you know, what this all means. Lauren and I are going to talk about this more next week at the World War I Museum in Kansas City. But this definitely seems escalatory on the Taliban side, and no real demonstrable progress or path forward, it feels like, for the government or the U.S. piece.
But interestingly, a couple of the reports came out in the last couple weeks on the coalition side, the U.S. side, noting a few things of interest. One, that we have dropped, the United States has dropped more munitions in Afghanistan in the last 10 months than it did in any year prior for the last 10 years, which is kind of astonishing, given that 10 years ago, let's see, 10 years ago we had...
It was before the surge.
Right.
So
before the surge. But then like that, but that's inclusive of the surge.
Right, exactly.
So that clearly indicates some kind of escalation or change in air strategy of some kind. The other report that came out that was of interest, and folks who follow Larry Lewis may have already seen this, the fact that we are now, the United States is now releasing more information on their airstrikes, and that is inclusive of the kinds of targets that they are choosing. A report that came out from the Bureau of Investigative Journalism is that in the last 2 months, there have been 60 strikes on buildings and structures that are usually the most high-risk targets for civilians. So in the past, basically, if you wanted to strike a building, the assumption was that it would probably or possibly have civilians within it. You'd have to go to a very high senior official within the coalition to get approval to be able to do so. So either that has become significantly easier to get that approval, or possibly has been delegated down in a way that has made that process easier, or that has changed altogether and we just don't know. This is one of the unfortunate things about how some of those processes work. You don't necessarily know what's going on behind the scenes.
And kind of to the point of both the air raids and the civilian casualties on the Afghan side, the casualties and KIAs on the coalition side, is I think we still have a sort of outstanding question that Erin will love that I'm about to ask, which is like, what would forward progress on Afghanistan look like? And like, what is it you'd say we're doing there? And I think like the fact that we have an uptick in munitions, the fact that it looks like the Taliban's going on the offensive, they're all like sort of interesting side notes, but it's not clear like what our counter would be, what the use of airstrikes or munition disposals and generally U.S. kinetic actions are. And so I think we're kind of like second verse, same as the first.
Oh, we're well past the second verse, I think.
83rd verse, same as the first.
I mean, I think you could make an interesting argument depending on what other data we're telling you, which is that we have seen the Taliban indicate willingness to negotiate this year, and they had an open letter to the American people, you know, 6 or 7 months ago. There've definitely been active back channels on negotiation. Zalmay Khalilzad is now involved, you know, on sort of as a special representative from the U.S. on reconciliation efforts. All of those things could be a result of increased pressure from the U.S. side and have convinced the Taliban that they need to come to the table. That would be an extremely optimistic reading. But, you know, again, I think we've talked about this a little bit before. The Taliban tend to be pretty good at fighting and talking, and we always seem to want to have to do one and then the other. Like, we're much more sequential about it. And so I think it's just a trickier thing to figure out what our political strategy is and how that lines up with the military piece. This is one of those things where it was always hard to figure out, even when we did have something resembling a whole of government approach, which is a phrase that I can't stand, but is even harder to tell right now because it's just like Scotty Miller and like five guys in Tampa kind of running things. Like, I'm not even sure kind of who here in Washington's paying a ton of attention.
On that happy note.
Meanwhile, did you guys pay attention to what happened in the Ukraine this week?
So my problem with what happened in the Ukraine this week is that anytime somebody says the Sea of Azov, I always get the consonants mixed up and want to say the Sea of...
Avos?
Yeah, yeah. So I'm always reluctant to talk about it because I'm going to make myself sound like an ass just like from the outset. But shit went down there, I think, as a start.
I think that's a good description.
They lost some boats? Three boats?
Three boats? 12 sailors? 24 sailors. Well, they didn't lose them so much as they were taken. They know where they are, I would guess.
You'd be a good RT journalist, Rada.
It's a fair point.
So on November 25th, the Russians seized three Ukrainian Navy vessels and detained the crew. A few days later, they then sent senior members, at least, of the crew to Moscow, which did not seem like an effort to like reduce tensions.
And also blocks one of the entrance to the sea with a large freighter.
Right. So the Sea of Azov is kind of this, I don't know, almost more like a lake that's off the Black Sea. I had to spend some time with Google Maps to sort of understand exactly this Kerch Strait and all these sorts of things, which everyone has become an expert on in the last, you know, 6 or 7 days.
Including us,
obviously. Meanwhile, today, the Ukrainian president, Poroshenko, made some pretty dramatic claims about numbers of Russian troops and naval vessels that were kind of in the vicinity, claiming that there are 80,000 Russian soldiers and several hundred naval vessels in the Sea of Azov and through the Black Sea. This is because those troops are stationed is a strong word. Those troops are allegedly located in Crimea, which of course is the region of the Ukraine that Russia annexed, and in some other sort of separatist-ish areas where little green men have been running around for the last couple of years. So I will fully admit that I have had a great deal of trouble following this in detail over the last several years, but it seems unusual or odd that this would be the escalate, like, why this week? You know, why this month? Why the Sea of Azov? And kind of, is there a longer game, or did somebody just get bored?
I got a couple guesses.
Yeah, I was like, I don't have good answers to a lot of that, but I think there are two pieces to this. One, because everything is a little bit about trade.
We're not to that section yet.
I know, but we need to know this here. So actually, the Sea of Azov is like really important for Ukraine's export market, and in particular, grain and steel. So like not being able to have free passage through actually is like a sort of meaningful, you know, reminder of...
It's too bad you guys can't see Rada's face when she says these things. She's so pleased with herself.
It's really exciting, guys, when trade comes into all of our national security talk. But this, the second piece, I think, is I do wonder how much of this is like trying to get just like making the irreversibility of the Crimean annexation. Like, I mean, there's nothing Ukraine's going to do about it now, but just kind of making that be a permanent thing and something Ukraine is going to sort of really accept and internalize, and making it difficult for them to have these sort of exports feels like a way to kind of force that question.
There's a couple other dynamics there as well. One being that the Ukrainian election is coming up in early spring, I think March mm-hmm. of next year. So, you know, how Poroshenko responds to this, which lately his response has been to declare martial law in order to muster more troops,
that's
which,
right.
you know, that's totally what every rational democracy does in the face
Nothing
of aggression.
Could go wrong with that.
Yep. So the depending on how the Ukrainian people feel about that, it could obviously have an impact. But also Putin's own popularity within Russia is slightly shakier than normal. And when I say slightly shakier, I mean like less from slightly stepped down from demigod, which is
yeah, it's like 98% instead of 99.9%.
Right, more or less. But with that, his typical response to such things is to go on extracurricular military interventions of some kind, which usually win him back some of that popularity. But in the absence of Western response to this aggression anyway, or any kind of response to this aggression that's really going to harm him, it's not likely he's going to step back from it, and it's entirely likely he'll continue to pursue.
Which brings us to the G20, which is a conference going on literally as we speak. It'll be over by the time this episode is released, but going on in Buenos Aires right now, which I always just hear in like the Madonna Evita voice, you know, like, let's go Buenos Aires. So that's, you know,
good. Don't cry for me, Argentina.
But there've been a number of statements released out of the G20. We're going to let Radha talk about the trade stuff in just a minute. So hold your horses, Radha. And, but there were statements on, essentially, if not quite condemning, because of course Russia is a member of the G20, so they didn't participate in the condemnation of this action in the Ukraine. But there were statements on the Ukraine. There were statements on climate, where everyone but us agreed to continue yeah. actions consistent with the Paris climate accords. And there were also lots of I don't know, parlor watching, or you know, some high school dance type ritual where you watched all the different people with their different sidebar meetings. I mean, I mostly know about this in meme form from Twitter, which I guess mostly is about like Mohammed bin Salman and Putin high-fiving on their meeting, which, yeah, that was...
Yeah.
There's some good tweets about that, but man, they're really bleak. Meanwhile, President Trump canceled his meeting with Putin, but then maybe talked to him informally at a dinner last night.
He probably almost certainly did. Like, this is what's so fascinating about these meetings. These people don't get to hang out as a group very often. So you're like the most popular of most popular kids who have egos the size of, you know, Mount Rushmore, all get together and get to try to impress one another and let their hair down. So stuff is always going to go on behind the scenes. You can't exactly predict. People will remember from, I guess it was last year, when the president and Putin had like multi-hour long conversation off the side of a dinner at one point in time. Like,
what I remember from last year's is Shinzo Abe's wife pretending like she doesn't speak English.
That was beautiful. God, that was great.
But there were trade things that also happened. We will transition now into the trade segment and let Radha regale us with such things. I saw something about they want to reform the WTO, question mark.
That's right. They're going to do some things to the WTO. I mean, like, to be honest, there are probably a number of changes that need to happen to the WTO. And the most significant part of this statement is that everyone kind of admitted agreeing to that, especially a number of the attributes that related to enforcement and dispute resolution that people feel the Chinese have sort of unfairly been taken advantage of. So I think that's a good piece of it. And at the same time, we actually got a statement, A, which doesn't always happen when the president of the United States goes to these kinds of summits, and B, a statement that reaffirmed that, like, we think trade is good. So we like trade still. So that's... notably, for the first time, the statement did not condemn protectionism or complain that it might be, like, you know, problematic and, I don't know, inhibiting trade, even though it's like literally the point of protectionism. So that was widely seen as a sort of concession to President Trump on the set of issues on trade. Two other quick things of note, which are, one, they also noted everyone except the United States is in the Paris Agreement. So it was like everyone minus one for Paris and leading a response to climate change. And there was also, and I'll include some more details on this in the show notes, but there was also a sidebar and sort of continuing warming of the relationship between Modi and Xi.
And that's the Indian Prime Minister.
Yes, that's the Indian Prime Minister. So he has a number of Trump-like qualities himself. So he tweeted out about how awesome it was for them to hang out shortly after the meetings. And they've had, folks might remember, there was a number of skirmishes along the Sino-Indian border sort of earlier this year, that had ratcheted down with a meeting between Modi and Xi, and there now seems to be a sort of warming of relations. They will meet actually next month directly themselves in a bilateral discussion. So I think interesting to see sort of what happens there as China continues to expand trade influence, especially with the U.S. out of the TPP and India sort of looking to identify markets for its goods and figure out how to divvy up the space there with China.
India, of course, is famously protectionist in its own right and has very little foreign access to its markets. So that's an interesting dynamic there. Can you tell us more about NAFTA 2.0, or as we like to call it, USMCA?
I can tell you all sorts of things about it, but I should let us know that, guys, it's the best trade deal because the old trade deal was the worst. And this is a number one, the best. So a lot of the rules are things we knew were coming. There's a change in the rules on what counts of country of origin. So it has to be 75% instead of 62.5%. Notably, actually, much higher wages for auto industry workers, which should both be good for Mexican workers and, in principle, increase the price of Mexican-produced goods to make U.S. goods more competitive. There's going to be some more access to the dairy market, which was a big concession by the Canadians, and then a bunch of boring stuff on IP and trade dispute resolution. The big notable thing is that Section 232, which is the exemption that Trump uses to impose various tariffs on things like aluminum and steel, remains in place. So it's like, it's probably a needed update of a 25-year-old, I think, agreement that we had, right? So there are lots of things that needed to get fixed up in it. Would you really call it a whole new and totally different agreement? Like, meh.
Especially with such a terrible name.
Yeah, I mean, it's fine, but, so I think the big thing is that Trump actually signed it and kind of, it seems to have agreements in both Canada and Mexico. And I think if executed, it would be a pretty good sort of delivery for him on campaign promises, which is like not a small thing.
It does need to be ratified by the Senate, by both houses of Congress. I actually don't know.
I have absolutely no idea.
I think it's both houses because trade agreements have to go through the House Ways and Means first, actually.
The most relevant fact that I have at the moment is that Canada does not call it USMCA. Because
what do they call it?
I think they just call it like the next NAFTA or NAFTA 2.0, because in Canada, agreements start with Canada, not the U.S.
That's hilarious.
To be fair, I don't know what Mexico is calling it.
I thought this was just going to be one of these things where they rearrange the letters like OTAN, but no.
Probably.
So much deeper than that.
That's right. That'd be great. Anything else in trade, dearest Radha?
No, but I would just like to say that, I think we have this agreement, but it does seem like, we're not really friends with Canada and Mexico, and Justin Trudeau does still seem to have pretty strong words for Trump on protectionism. So it would kind of be interesting to see, what actually happens after we try to move forward with this deal with some of those trade relations, because we're, it's not all warm and fuzzy still.
And to what degree is the administration going to be in any way decent at pushing this forward on the Hill, which they have not been terribly successful at any of their Hill priorities whatsoever,
besides
regardless
the tax
of the Congress.
Cut.
So I wish them the best of luck. May God have mercy on their soul.
Speaking of the Hill, the White House actually had a pretty gnarly week on the Hill. Obviously, we've had elections, but the new members have not been seated yet, right? So the old Congress is back in session, and it's, old Congress same means the new Congress in some ways, except there was a vote first there was testimony from Secretary Mattis and Pompeo this week with regard to Yemen and with regard to Saudi Arabia as well. Notably absent from that hearing was one Gina Haspel, the CIA director,
who was invited, according to both the chair and the ranking member of the SFRC. But according to the CIA, she was not told by the White House not to go, but she didn't go. So the definition of told might be
complicated
under debate.
There.
And just to make a little process my Valentine question, Lauren, which you might know this the best, how do a senior administration official gets invited to the Hill, does the White House have to give them permission? Can they just rock up? Like, what's the normal sort of order of business here?
I mean,
is this weird? that she didn't go and ask?
It is sort of weird. Like there, so one of the issues here is that the CIA is obviously, or sorry, the SFRC is not obviously not Gina Haspel's committee of jurisdiction. So the fact that Mattis goes up and testifies before them in any way, shape, or form is actually kind of interesting anyway. It is not always typical for you to have kind of joint testimonies between multiple agencies in that way. Sometimes administrations are a little testy about exactly that matter. But it's usually to their benefit to have that, particularly for state, to have DOD to come sit next to them and be like, hey, no, this is actually really important to our national security. That usually wins them friends and allies in some form. But in this case, obviously, what the Senate was interested in was not actually the success of U.S. Support for coalition operations in Yemen, but was actually more about Jamal Khashoggi and the degree to which Canadian, I can't believe I just said that, Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman was involved in the murder of Jamal Khashoggi in Turkey.
And it turns out the CIA has a real strong opinion about that. We talked about that on the last episode. There is still SIGINT in my Twitter feed. There is new stuff out today. I cannot believe this. And so we're still debating this. It turns out the Senate was pretty not thrilled. They were not, I think, super persuaded by the answers provided by Secretaries Mattis and Pompeo. They were real shirty about the fact that Gina Haspel didn't show up. And maybe that she'll do something else in a closed session with her own oversight committee, as sort of Lauren suggested. But it's hard to say.
At this point, do they need her to show up?
They don't, the New York Times, because they've already voted on a resolution, which happened this week, to end U.S. support for the Saudi war in Yemen. And sort of what's most interesting to me about this, so this resolution passed the Senate 63-37. That's with all 49 Democrats voting in favor and 14 Republican members. 6 months ago, that vote only got 44 ayes at all. Mm-hmm. So this is reflective at least of some sort of shift amongst on the Senate side of, you know, how either where they think the public's at or an objective reassessment of what they think our role should be with regard to the Saudis' engagement in Yemen and what they want our relationship with Saudi Arabia to be kind of more broadly. The resolution itself, I think, is fairly narrow, but it's also got some very odd bedfellows as its sponsors. Did you guys pay attention to this at all?
Sure, between Sanders, Mike Lee, and Chris Murphy.
Chris Murphy.
Yeah, those are all like that. They agree on basically nothing except for this to some degree. And though from a procedural matter, this isn't the final step in the Senate's actions here. This
no,
is basically
for sure.
Opening floor debate.
Right.
On top of which, the likelihood of this passing, a version of this passing on the House side in this particular Congress is pretty low.
I can't imagine it even gets to the floor.
But on the other hand, I think it has a greater potential than it might have had 6 months ago, to Aaron's point. However, in the next Congress, where they would still have to start over again, it's far more likely, even if they don't do it exactly, get exactly this kind of formulation that would completely cut off U.S. support for any hostilities in Yemen whatsoever, you could see them constraining financial support or constraining U.S. activity there in other ways beyond what they've already done right now, which is cut off refueling.
An interesting week kind of on the Saudi foreign policy piece, and I expect we'll have an occasion to return to this because it's certainly going to be the new House majority is going to take a look at this pretty closely. People will be asked to testify in front of some of those committees as well, I would bet, when they get new chairpersons.
Also, to give them some credit, this would be the first time, if this actually manages to go forward, this would be the first time since, I believe, Cambodia/Vietnam, that Congress has done anything to constrain U.S. war powers or U.S. Use of force of in any way, shape, or form overseas.
The Boland Amendments in the 80s are kind of on the line. That's a funding thing, not a deployment or like a use of force sort of thing.
Right,
but,
doing so under the War Powers Resolution, not doing so under other possibilities that they could do.
Meanwhile, the GOP senators were also busy providing some questions to the president on extension of the New START treaty. So we talked about the INF treaty a couple weeks ago. Interestingly, we have not, to my mind, as far as I know, officially told the Russians that we would like to leave the INF treaty. So that is still just like a thing that basically happened on Twitter, but hasn't happened in real life yet.
I think we've gone out. The DNI has gone out and formally said what the violation is.
Yes.
Which is,
but I don't think we've
taken a long ass time.
I don't think we've actually notified them that we're leaving. Meanwhile, so New START, which is the strategic arms reductions treaty that is currently in effect between the United States and Russia. It's set to expire in 2021. And that there's an option to extend. It can be extended without renegotiating any terms, or the parties could return to the table and try to come up with some new pieces.
Aaron, remind us what strategic arms are and why we're reducing them.
Yeah, because those are nuclear weapons. So
thank you.
And by strategic,
strategic doesn't mean just like a vague word that you add to your tweet to make yourself sound cooler this time.
That's right.
I know, but it always kind of feels like it is.
It is the case. There's a generation of people when they say strategic weapons, they mean very, very specific things, and they don't mean aircraft carriers, right? So the new START treaty replaces some earlier START treaties. There have actually been several, and some were ratified, but not all of them were. That's not material. But John Kyle, Tom Cotton, Liz Cheney, and some others want to make sure that the president is aware of their questions, their concerns about Russian behavior, one of which is that they think they're violating the INF treaty, and so we should be very wary of them complying with the new START treaty, even though there's no evidence that they have violated their obligations under new START. The senators are also concerned that the new START treaty only covers, as we said, the strategic, which is essentially the long-range nuclear weapons, and doesn't cover any of the tactical nuclear weapons, which to my mind is actually very similar to a lot of these same folks' complaints about the JCPOA, the Iran deal, which was that it only covered the Iranian nuclear program and not all of the other potential things that you could want Iran to change its behavior on. And so because any one of these treaties doesn't cover all of the things, we're quite irritated, and we are therefore deeply skeptical that we should extend it or continue our obligations under it.
So maybe we should have one treaty that just governs everything.
One treaty
that
rule them all.
All the members of it meet in New York and talk about things there and have black helicopters. Do you think that people would like that?
I'm sure that would solve all of their concerns, because I believe they have good faith objections to these things.
Yes.
I do think, like, the other piece of this is that, as Aaron points out, you know, there's a whole generation of people who thought a lot about these kinds of strategic arms and really understood them and had a prioritization and understanding. And now it feels like there's kind of like nuclear weapons-ish things.
She's waving her hand. You can't see
I'm
this.
I'm waving my hand. Yeah, sorry. And I do think there's probably a time and a space now to have a conversation on, like, why do we make these different distinctions between different weapons, strategic or not? Why do we care about long range versus medium range, tactical versus strategic? Like, what is the terrible thing we're trying to prevent, and what's kind of the order of operations on the treaties? And I feel like there's a set of people, and sadly, many of them are in charge of making decisions about this right now, that don't understand some of those, like, sort of fundamental issues about nuclear weapons. And so we're in a weird space where we need to make decisions and update them, but we don't have the kind of expertise we used to have to talk to those folks about them.
And certainly there's a real strategic logic to arms control, which is that it kind of reduces the number of weapons, but it also reduces the number of aim points. And it provides a lot of information for both sides about the other side's capabilities and weaponry. So a lot of intelligence folks and a lot of planners actually really like arms control agreements, because it makes the problem set that they're trying to tackle very, very clear.
Yeah. I mean, it has a number of follow-on effects, most directly things like missile defense and other types of response programs, right? So it is really useful, but I don't think that's a conversation that, like, they're necessarily having when they note that strategic arms control doesn't cover, I don't know, tactical nukes in Japan.
We shall see. This is definitely going to be part of an interesting set of debates, obviously, about New START extension and kind of how the INF piece plays into this as well. All of that is going on while we're also debating funding for modernizing pretty much every leg of our nuclear triad, and even potentially a couple of new systems. And so that is a debate we really haven't had since the 1980s, when we had peacekeeper missiles and we're discussing the original START treaties, the original arms reductions that Reagan and Gorbachev went through. So it's kind of a back to the future moment, and we'll see. You know, what all of us kids who've grown up with the war on terror, just how much we can learn about strategic weapons and arms control and that sort of thing in the next few years. What else do we have for White House mayhem?
Well, the government might shut down next week, or half of it.
Part of it, right.
Because we not the Defense Department, which, like, had its own spending bill on time
and
for
so
the first time in ages.
That means that nobody realizes that we forgot to fund the rest of the government in the process.
Which is ironic, given that we didn't fund DHS or the border, which is apparently where most of our U.S. forces are right now and will be through at least January.
So, yes. Yeah, so the continuing resolution expires next week. And we'll kind of see if they can come to an agreement. I mean, really, border wall funding is once again the sort of place where people are drawing lines in the sand, and we're trying to figure out if that's going to get any funding or not.
Democrats also want to sneak in, I say sneak in as though it's not like the most prominent priority on the face of the earth, sneak in a provision to effectively protect the Mueller investigation in some way.
Oh, yes.
McConnell is highly unlikely to do that. I know that shocks everyone.
Well, speaking of the Mueller investigation, it was a really busy week in the world of Trump and Manafort and Michael Cohen and L'Affaire Russe. And we're obviously not going to dig into that in great detail. But there was one piece of information and kind of a blockbuster story that BuzzFeed had out this week that Michael Cohen, the president's lawyer, was actively trying to set up a deal for a Trump hotel in Moscow, basically throughout the duration of the 2016 campaign. And so there's two pieces of that. One is that he lied to Congress about that. And it turns out that's like totally a felony and you will straight up go to jail for that, which was perhaps a surprise to some other people.
Yeah. I think people were like, oh, what could Congress do about that? Actually, Congress isn't the one who does something about that.
Yeah, exactly. But also it means that all the times that the president said that he wasn't actively pursuing a deal in Russia, the Russians knew he was lying. And so for one thing, like, that is just the biggest counterintelligence problem you can imagine. I mean, other than being like actively and formally recruited and a clear agent of a foreign power, that's as bad of a counterintelligence problem as you could have for a presidential candidate, which is that a foreign
only if you care about people thinking you're a liar.
I mean, I guess, but clearly there was a lot of people talked about how they weren't going to say this out loud. So somebody cared about saying this in public. Otherwise, Michael Cohen wouldn't have lied to Congress about it. So, I mean, so I think there was a pretty clear understanding that if this came out, it would be bad, because Michael Cohen wasn't the only person who lied to Congress about it. The second piece of this that also just really struck me, and thinking about this in terms of like, you know, this is all swirling as Trump's like literally on a plane to Argentina to go to the G20. And like, you know, again, like what like is the big takeaway for like, why do we care whether or not he was like doing deals with the Russians or not? Because his defense is like, I was running my business. I didn't think I would win. So I just, you know, kept doing my business. And the answer, at least my answer on this is that, you know, you've got to be able to believe at some level that the president is acting on behalf of American interests and American national security and not just private interests. And like one of the biggest challenges with the president and his business interests and the way that his family is involved both in the business and in the government is that there's no distinction. Right. There's just the set of things that actually make them look good or do well. And you have no ability to tell if any particular activity that he embarks on as president is for private gain or for the public good. And I think that that's like one of the things that's like makes me the most cynical, but it's like the hardest to sort of reconcile. It's like not even like a purely partisan thing. It's just that this deeply private period interest that is part and parcel with the Oval Office.
And our system is not actually really set up to deal with that.
No.
It's set up to deal with it. Our system is sort of premised on the president, at the very least the president, if no one else, acting in the best interest of the country, and sort of like that being the core issue, and then others sort of demonstrating compliance beyond that. But so when you have a president who may be acting in sort of bad faith or for personal gain, it's like, other than norms and sort of general tutting, we don't have a great number of mechanisms to do anything about that. In elections, I guess we have elections.
Yeah, to close out that point, as a part of a project that I'm doing for my real life job, interviewing a lot of current and former civil servants, they talk about the fact that they never really had to consider before whether or not political appointees were operating in any other interest other than the American people's, and that they may be acting in business interests that are either of their own or somebody else's, and that they have absolutely no mechanism to do anything about that, and how really kind of disconcerting it is to realize that this is something that our system, as you say, Radha, is just absolutely not set up for, not only at the presidential level, but even like at a low-level political appointee level.
That's not like especially reassuring. So I guess we'll see, you know, whether elections, you know, obviously the midterms maybe are a referendum on that in some way. And I think we talked last time about, or a couple weeks ago, about the kinds of oversight that we might see from the House, at least going forward. But it is just a really challenging. I mean, the president is right. It's actually like not a crime to pursue a business deal in a foreign country while you run for president. It probably is a crime to encourage people to lie to investigators about that. And so we'll see if that, in fact, did happen. But we'll refer folks to the Lawfare podcast and to Rational Security for deeper insights on these matters. But it does just strike me as a really difficult thing, because we see it even with like the deployment to the border, right, which seemed like a pretty thin veil of a midterm election stunt in many ways, even though that deployment's, I guess, now going to be extended through the new year. So to
move over. Oh, wait, can we move to pop culture yet? I've got a
yes,
pop culture
please,
question.
Please,
wait,
move
one,
us.
One quick, okay. No, wait, one quick thing. Sorry, borders. Because like, I just have like more or less two or three quick things to say on this. And see, I have to say that up front, so Aaron lets me say all of them. Hmm. So folks know there was the infamous caravan was making it to the border in the U.S. There were a large crowd of asylum seekers who came to the border to apply, and they were the Border Patrol agents set off tear gas. It should be noted, and was noted, in fact, by White House spokespersons that this isn't the first time tear gas has been used at the border. And in fact, it was used at the border semi-regularly in 2012 and 2013. But actually, after Ferguson, the Obama administration at the time did a big deep dive into sort of rules of engagements and appropriate use of force at the border and what constituted, and tried to put in both rules of engagement, sort of limiting the amount of tear gas that could be used, and also efforts at sort of accountability and transparency in reporting the amount of these types of incidents, sort of more serious escalatory incidents. So after doing that, the amount of tear gas usage and use of force went down dramatically in 2014 and beyond. It's ticked up since then. So this is not the first time the Trump administration has used this sort of level of force at the border, though it is, as many sort of folks note, first time it's been used at a really large crowd, and a crowd with women and very small children who could face serious harm from such tear gas. So it's a sort of notable change in the rules of force, but in also in the sort of efforts to curtail and think about how we do and don't treat the border. And in the context of both some of the conversations we had, was it just the last episode where we talked about sort of forces deployed to the border and under what authorities and what they were allowed to do, as well as the sort of upcoming border wall. It's just worth keeping in mind that there are a number of moving pieces happening here on the border, which are not happy, but are happening.
You actually stuck to like 3 points there. That was great.
Arata always sticks to the number of points. That's not a problem.
Okay. Well, okay. On pop culture, this has been bothering me like for the last 20 minutes. most prominently when Aaron was talking very eloquently about presidential ethics. Okay, so Michael Cohen, who will play him in the movie? Will it be, none of these are perfect, so you gotta use your imagination here. Will it be John Cusack, John Favreau, or the reanimated or AI version of James Gandolfini?
No, Steve Buscemi.
No, the dude from SVU.
Okay.
What dude from SVU?
Which dude from SVU?
Chris... What's his name?
I got nothing, man.
Sorry. We'll have to look it up.
All right.
I mean, like any of those people, it can't be John Cusack. People like John Cusack too much.
But like if he got kind of like bloated and fat and grew out his eyebrows a little.
You mean like did what Christian Bale did to play Dick Cheney?
Yeah, exactly.
Because that movie's coming out soon.
Right. I saw an amazing tweet the other day that like Amy Adams will finally win an Oscar, and it will be with when she's playing Mrs. Cheney.
Oh, wow. I saw Widows last weekend, which has Viola Davis and mm-hmm. Liam Neeson, and is like quite a good heist film for folks who are interested, and has an excellent, excellent cast. My brother and I are going to see Creed 2 tonight. But really what I'm dying to see is The Favorite. Have you guys seen these previews?
No.
Olivia Colman and other people.
Yes.
it looks amazing.
While you're talking about Creed 2, people who are like super internet people should definitely track down the woman who posted the fake photo of herself and Michael B. Jordan, and then later was able to acquire a real photo of herself and Michael B. Jordan. It is an epic, epic story, and you should just really enjoy it.
Radha, do you have any pop culture?
I started watching My Brilliant Friend.
Oh, excellent.
Which I highly recommend.
How many episodes have you watched?
Two.
What do you think?
I think it's pretty good. I mean, I love, love, love the books. This will shock everyone. And so I was pleased to see like the like flavor of the books in addition to like the sort of plot seems to be captured in it, at least so far. I was, for no reason at all, thought that it would just be in English. So that was a little surprise.
It's super not. This is the Neapolitan stories, the four book series that many of us read last summer and the summer before. And now it's a series on HBO. And it's...
Yeah,
it's,
so the first book is an 8-part miniseries, I believe.
It's very good, but it's all in Italian / like Neapolitan dialect.
Yeah, so you have to like watch it because you need the words on the screen. But it's worth it. It's worth actually watching.
Anything else, ladies?
I got nothing.
We'll see everyone in a couple weeks. Thanks.